content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine's edition, dated August 17, 2026. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is almost not visible on the cover because it's in large block capital lettering in white on a very pale ivory background. Three individuals' faces are shown on the cover. I think one is Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State. One is Ms. Rodriguez of Venezuela. One is President Trump. And surrounding them are images of a flag, not ours, so presumably it's Venezuelan, a ship, an airplane, an oil derrick, and other people walking in the foreground, and palm trees, and more flags. This will be addressed in an article that I will read later. For now, I'm opening with the brief from this new edition of Time. Shock the Vote by Philip Elliott. And there's a full-page photo here in color of people. Oh, let's see. One, two, three, four, five people at little voting booths. They look like they're temporary, portable, I should say. They have blue legs, off-white tabletop, and then the little three-sided privacy sections that say vote on them with the U.S. flag. There are actually a couple of, one, two, three, empty voting booths here at the moment. The carpeting in this place is dark blue, and there are double doors in view, so it's easy to walk right in and vote here. One page, written by Philip Elliott. President Donald Trump's July 16 show from the White House had all the drama. New documents pulled from the forgotten archives. Reports of guns, faked voter registration documents, gift card payments for forgeries, documents that Barack Obama had tossed into burn bags to hide from his successor. Fake ballots printed by China. Ballot rigging by Venezuela. And North Korea plotting vote changing. For Trump's base, of which 66% already believe the 2020 results were rigged, the night was a confirmation of their suspicions that the system is so corrupt nothing can be trusted. Trump, with documents he said he declassified with the help of his spy chiefs, had finally proved foreign actors were the real reason he had lost. But almost immediately, the new documents, some with heavy redactions, told a more complicated story. Trump's presentation was a rhetorical win, but a fact-checker's minefield. And while he may have met his goal of leaving his supporters incensed, even that may end up backfiring bigly. New word, I think, bigly. Election data are complicated. Trump made some claims that left viewers with the impression that hundreds of millions of Americans' personal information had been hacked in 2020 by China in the largest compromise of election data in history. But in many cases, the information in question is already online in many states, put there by the boards of elections. So while China may have found out who could vote, That alone is not enough to prove malfeasance. And it was far from evidence that Beijing was doing anything unusual, let alone nefarious. So is Washington's relationship with Beijing, even before Trump began his speech, the Chinese embassy in Washington had a denial for reporters. Beijing has never and will never interfere in the presidential elections of the U.S. Complicating matters further is the upcoming late September visit to Washington by Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Trump and Xi have a delicate relationship, one that may define the century. Open feuding would be far from productive. Then there is this wrinkle. In the final days of Trump's first term, his own director of national intelligence at the time, John Ratcliffe, presented findings of the nation's spy organizations that, at least according to the unclassified version, there were no indications that any foreign actor, including China, attempted or succeeded in altering any technical aspect of the 2020 election vote. It took up just the last 2 minutes of Trump's 27-minute speech, but the one action item that might actually be added to Washington's agenda is an elections bill that does not have the votes in the Senate. Trump's obsession with the SAVE Act is rooted in his belief that voting is too easy for those who should not, and Democrats oppose the voter ID requirements and mail-in restrictions only because they get an advantage from the current system. But Trump did not have the votes going into the speech, and he did not have them coming out. Scary allegations are not the whole story. If voters listened to Trump's speech without any skepticism, things sounded really, really scary. But while there are kernels of truth to what Trump is saying, that was also true of the raw intelligence cherry-picked to justify invading Iraq. A low-confidence observation found in a file is different from a verified operation. Yes, voting is imperfect. No, it is not rife with corruption. Trump went 0 for 62 in court challenges to the 2020 vote. The presentation may backfire on Republicans. Certainly, the main headline for Trump's base was a "you told you so." At face value, the speech left voters with the impression he found a vault of evidence that the deep state buried findings that the 2020 election was not on the up and up. Foreign influence was everywhere in plain sight, and no one should really trust those results, or maybe even the results happening in elections in just a few months. But here is the thing about Trump's message. It might be factually specious, but it is politically resonant. Presented with this new hand-picked evidence, that base is only going to further distrust the entire democratic process. Presented as chicanery, it is tough to convince would-be voters that waiting in line to cast ballots is anything but a sucker's game. Eroding confidence in the system may help when you are claiming the Democrats may have stolen majorities in the House and Senate, but it's bad for democracy and GOP turnout. If Trump is going to avoid endless oversight hearings and maybe even a third impeachment, it will be harder if the Republicans only have a minority of either chamber. Trump may have felt good about his performance, but he may end up regretting it if his base sits out the balloting because the president convinced them voting is a waste of time. Next page, almost half a page of photo here. Everybody's saluting. Everybody looks like they're in a neighborhood. By everybody, I mean a couple of dozen men and women. Most are wearing caps that have some type of Legionnaire or VFW or other military insignia on the caps. Many are wearing blue shirts and red shirts, also with some type of military insignia or the stars and stripes on the shirts. A few in the background are standing as if pledging the allegiance with a hand over the heart. Others in the background are holding candles, unlit, and here's the caption, "The Toll of War." Veterans salute during a candlelight vigil for Sergeant Angel Sarah Rompersad outside her home in Queens, New York, July 27. Rompersad was killed during an Iranian attack on a military base in Jordan, July 17. Two others, First Lieutenant Tyler James Fian and Private Isabella Gonzalez, were also killed in the attack, bringing the U.S. death toll in the Iran war to 18. The Bulletin. Japanese PM provokes national debate on work boundaries, by Miranda Jayaratnam. For Japanese Prime Minister Sanae, that's S-A-N-A-E, Takaichi, a day off means more work. In July, as the country enjoyed a three-day weekend, Takaichi apparently spent the time poring over policy documents and catching up on domestic work. "I was able to get 5 hours of sleep for the first time in a while," she posted on social media. "Since taking office, getting 0 to 3 hours of sleep has become the norm." The perhaps surprising response to her post is evidence of what experts say is a larger shift in the country's work culture. Takaichi's post may have been meant as a kind of appeal to conservative voters, says Lee Hao, an associate professor at the University of Tokyo, implying she is maintaining both her political work and traditional gendered labor of women in the home. When Takaichi was elected president of the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, in October, she announced, "I will abandon the phrase work-life balance. I will work, 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 and keep on working." Some say it's a message that increasingly falls flat with young voters, as the post draws scrutiny from those who argue Takaichi is upholding an unhealthy, outdated standard. Opposition lawmakers have suggested she's overemphasizing quantity of work over quality. The criticism reflects a gradual shift in attitudes toward work and gender roles, says James Brown, professor of international affairs and political science at Temple University, Japan. "The traditional expectation was that a big part of your identity is as an employee." In May, Yawata Mayor Shoko Kawata faced backlash after announcing she had become Japan's first sitting mayor to take maternity leave, but several karoshi, or overwork death, cases have prompted labor reforms aimed at bettering work-life balance. Parts of the LDP have also shown concern given Japan's aging population and low birth rate. Takaichi's view, Brown says, is increasingly an outlier. Turning the page to the brief news, good question. "Where did India's cockroach movement come from?" by Connor Green. There's a photo here. It's a small photo. The backdrop looks like concrete. But the subject of the photo is probably a person. I see a white shirt or blouse with a white collar and a white headgear that covers the subject's hair, and in front there's a bug, an insect face. And the caption reads, a demonstrator at a CJP protest in Mumbai, July 16. What started as a satirical online campaign earlier this year has quickly swelled into a formidable real-world political force that has challenged Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's right-wing government and ousted one of its key officials, Education Minister Dharmendra Pradhan. The youth-led cockroach movement has seemed to come out of nowhere as tens of thousands of supporters of the Cockroach Janta Party, CJP, have taken to the streets across India since June to call for the resignation of Pradhan and reforms to India's troubled education system after a widespread leak of medical entrance exam questions nullified the results for more than 2 million students. In June, CJP members began staging a sit-in at Jantar Mantar, a Delhi landmark famous for protests, refusing to move until Pradhan resigned. Along with students, professionals, and families with young children, all joined the demonstration there. At one point, thousands of young people attempted to storm the parliament building in Delhi and faced violent suppression from the police. A separate sit-in was also held at Modi's residence, where Rahul Gandhi, leader of India's opposition party, the Indian National Congress, INC, which has also rallied behind the cockroach movement, was detained. One man, Sonam Wangchuk, an education activist who had been detained by Modi's government for past demonstrations, began a hunger strike that lasted 26 days and compelled government officials to make concessions to the group's demands. In the spring, Indian authorities voided the results of the May 3 National Eligibility Cum Entrance Test Exam, the country's highly competitive entrance exam for admission to undergraduate medical programs, after an investigation found questions had been leaked. Though the situation served as the spark for protests, the movement gained momentum by tapping into young people's broader anger over extremely high unemployment rates and economic pressures. The CJP itself was born in response to a comment that India's Chief Justice made during an unrelated hearing the same month of the testing scandal, to which she compared young, unemployed people to cockroaches and parasites. The movement's founder, Abhijit Dipki, who was then living in the U.S. after graduating from Boston University, wrote on his social media in response, "What if all cockroaches came together?" That initial post drew a huge reaction, and Dipki proceeded to build out the movement from there. He created social media accounts and a website for the Cockroach Janta Party, whose name references both the Chief Justice's remark and the country's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, and garnered a fast-growing following. Within mere weeks, over 20 million people followed Dipki's accounts, and the Modi government temporarily blocked the CJP's X account in the country. As the movement gained momentum, Dipki decided to return to India to lead it in Delhi and at events across the country. Build a party for the young people who keep getting called lazy, chronically online, and most recently, cockroaches, the CJP declares on its website. That's it. That's the mission. The rest is satire, and yet there is in fact more to the movement, which is now pushing for wider reforms. A manifesto on the website details 5 key demands. Restricting chief justices from being appointed to Parliament following their retirement. Arresting the chief election commissioner if any citizens' votes are erased. Reserving 50% of cabinet positions for women while raising the current quota to increase female representation across the government from 33% to 50%. Creating a more independent media, and barring any lawmaker who switches political parties from holding a government position for 20 years. A separate charter on the website titled 5 Demands to End India's Exam Crisis includes establishing new and reforming current examination bodies. After celebrating Pradhan's resignation in late July, Dipke said in a video to his millions of followers, "This is just the beginning." Here is the milestones page. I'll begin with the 2 articles. One is 1 column long, the other is slightly more. Hacked AI security test, loss of control. A small photo at the bottom of this column, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman. It looks like a regular guy's face. He's wearing a blue suit. We see only his shoulders, white shirt and blue tie. Face with neither smiling nor frowning, brown eyes looking at the camera. Brown hair, a little bit falling onto his forehead. OpenAI was evaluating its artificial intelligence model's ability to exploit vulnerable software, when instead, the models hacked the infrastructure surrounding the test, broke containment, and attacked a real company, OpenAI revealed July 21. Observers say this is the first real-world instance of AI doing something researchers have long worried about, a loss-of-control scenario. If the industry fails to learn from it, it is unlikely to be the last. Hugging Face, a company that hosts AI models and datasets, was the target of the autonomous attack, and reported the incident to police before it knew OpenAI's models were responsible. Many termed the incident a warning shot and have called for stronger containment. OpenAI said, "This incident points to the need to further strengthen our model's alignment, cyber protections during evaluation time, and monitoring during internal testing." Harry Booth wrote that article, and Jeffrey Kluger writes this one, recorded. 35-year high for measles. The outbreaks continue to spread. Measles is an old scourge that's rapidly re-emerging as a new one. According to numbers released by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, July 24, there have been 2,318 cases of measles reported nationwide so far this year, already exceeding the 2,289 cases reported in all of 2025. The current figure is the highest incidence of measles in 35 years. The surge has come amid a backdrop of changes to childhood vaccinations. In January 2026, the CDC changed the childhood vaccine schedule after President Donald Trump directed the agency to review other developed countries' vaccine recommendations. The new guidelines reduced the number of recommended vaccines for children from 17 to 11. Though the measles vaccine is still on the recommended list, Recent research published in Science showed changes in the CDC's messaging under the Trump administration reduce the public's trust in vaccines, while increasing perceptions they're not safe. Generally, it takes 95% vaccination coverage to achieve what is known as herd immunity. The protection that's afforded when there are so many people inoculated against a disease that the pathogen cannot gain an infectious toehold in society. Vaccination rates are not available for the 2025-2026 school year, but for 2024-2025, the number was just 92.5%, down from 95.2%. in 2019-2020. That much of a drop in vaccination coverage creates pockets for viruses to spread. Of measles cases so far in 2026 and for the entirety of last year, 93% have been among unvaccinated children. This year, 7% of those cases resulted in hospitalizations. There have been no deaths so far this year, but there were three in 2025, one of them an unvaccinated adult, and two of them unvaccinated children, said Dr. Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, in an email to Time. I think it's fair to say measles is epidemic in the United States. Shifting now to the left-hand column, there are five items that are short to read. Appointed Andy Burnham, B-U-R-N-H-A-M, as the UK's new Prime Minister after meeting with King Charles III July 20, making him the country's seventh leader in 10 years. Opened the Gordie Howe International Bridge, linking Detroit and Windsor, Ontario, July 27. Intended as a symbol of trade ties, the bridge has become a locus of U.S.-Canada tensions. Announced a full-term run for the late Senator Lindsey Graham's South Carolina seat by his sister, Darlene Graham Nordone, July 20. She had been tapped to serve as his temporary replacement after his death July 11. Died German scientist Günther von Huygens, who created the controversial Body Worlds exhibits featuring posed human corpses July 24 at 81. Von Huygens previously said after he died he wanted his body to be plastinated and presented at one of his exhibits. Diagnosed, singer-songwriter Carly Simon with Parkinson's disease, she revealed to the AP July 27. I'm going now to the cover story under the heading World, the New U.S. Colony, How a Socialist Dictatorship Became an American Protectorate, by Eric Cortalesa Caracas, and reporting is also by Leslie Dickstein. This is a lengthy article, and I may abridge it. And indeed, on the cover, it was Delcy Rodriguez, Venezuela's acting president. She's seated here in this photograph at the Miraflores Palace in Caracas. She's tan-skinned. She has long black hair, straight, shoulder length. She's wearing dark-rimmed glasses. She has dark eyes, a bit of blush on her cheeks and her lips, wearing purple, looking askance of the camera. Delcy Rodriguez, acting president of Venezuela, conducts the nation's business out of Miraflores Palace, a 19th-century neoclassical mansion in the heart of Caracas. Gilded portraits of Simon Bolivar and Hugo Chavez gaze down on the ornate halls. Birds chirp in the manicured gardens. An unusually tight security detail shadows Rodriguez every step. The caution is understandable. Not long ago, the U.S. sent a Delta Force unit into her predecessor's residence on a nearby military base to seize the man she had served for years, which may help explain Rodriguez's careful manner. She speaks regularly with President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and her English is nearly flawless. Yet when she sits down with Time for a rare interview with an American media outlet, she summons a translator. I suggest it would be easier to speak in English. When I do interviews, I like to do them in Spanish, she says. I'm not sure that's best for this one, I say. It is best for me, she replies with a faint smile. It is easy to understand her strategy. Speaking through an interpreter slows the conversation and gives Rodriguez greater control over the words that ultimately reach the page. It is the instinct of a disciplined operator who has spent decades in one of the world's most unforgiving political systems and who is now navigating an extraordinary diplomatic moment. A socialist stalwart who rose through Chavez's inner circle before serving for years as Nicolas Maduro's second-in-command, Rodriguez, 57, was among the most recognizable faces of a movement largely defined for decades by its hostility toward the U.S. Today, she's the steward of a remarkable rapprochement with Washington. In exchange for U.S. support, she's allowed Trump and Rubio to turn Venezuela into a de facto vassal state, giving them an unprecedented degree of influence over her country. In an hour-long interview, Rodriguez insists she is not surrendering Venezuelan sovereignty, but opening the country's economy in the best interests of its people. I'm starting out by acting in good faith and trusting that these relationships can develop in good faith, she tells me. My current and future strategy has always been to ensure peace and tranquility in the country, tranquility and social and economic well-being. The nation Rodriguez now governs is not the same country that existed before the raid that captured Maduro. Before his fall, Venezuela was in stark decline, riddled with corruption, teetering on economic collapse, ruled by an authoritarian who the U.S. and independent international observers say stole his 2024 election. Hyperinflation had wiped out citizen savings. Oil production, the lifeblood of the economy, had plummeted after years of graft, underinvestment, and sanctions. Nearly 8 million Venezuelans had fled, fueling the largest migration crisis in the history of the Western Hemisphere. Rolling blackouts, water scarcity, crumbling hospitals, shortages of food and medicine had become routine. Once among Latin America's wealthiest nations, Venezuela had developed into one of its poorest. Since Rodriguez's ascension in January, signs of recovery have begun to emerge. Construction cranes have appeared all over parts of Caracas. Store shelves are fuller. Dormant oil fields are stirring back to life. American companies, including ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, Halliburton, GE Vernova, have returned or begun negotiating new investments. Commercial flights between the U.S. and Venezuela have resumed for the first time since 2019. The dollar circulates openly. Foreign executives, diplomats, investors are filling hotels. The lobby of the JW Marriott is now a gathering place for oil executives, while at the more exclusive Cayena Caracas, impeccably dressed financiers and government officials mingle amid polished marble and soft jazz discussing exploration rights, infrastructure contracts, Venezuela's future. All this has come at a price. Under an arrangement overseen by Rubio, the U.S. has become deeply involved in Venezuelan state affairs. In an arrangement described to Time by three senior U.S. and Venezuelan officials. The U.S. Secretary of State supervises the framework governing Venezuela's oil revenues and public finances, effectively administering a joint fund that gives Washington influence over everything, from how the country's export earnings are allocated to the reopening of the energy sector to preferential treatment for American companies. Rubio and Rodriguez are in near daily contact through phone calls and WhatsApp messages, officials say. Rodriguez consults him on domestic appointments, including her selection of a defense minister, according to three officials familiar with the arrangement. Basically, you have what they call the Rodrigato operating, says James Story, a former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela under Presidents Trump and Biden, describing an arrangement in which Rodriguez's government remains in power while carrying out Washington's strategic priorities. They are doing everything we ask them to do. As we sit in a room of polished marble and gold leaf, Rodriguez recounts the chain of events that propelled her to power with the soft, measured cadence of someone accustomed to exercising authority without raising her voice. January 2, she recalls, she met with Maduro to discuss Venezuela's economic plans and the ongoing naval blockade the U.S. had imposed since December. Afterwards, she flew to Margarita Island, the Caribbean resort off Venezuela's northern coast, where her brother and nephews were vacationing. She arrived around 11 p.m., only a few hours before frantic phone calls began. In the early hours of the morning, U.S. military units infiltrated Maduro's compound inside the Fort Tiuna military complex as he slept. They found him in his pajamas, arrested him, whisked him and his wife out of the country. We went through a moment of great anguish when we thought they had killed the President and First Lady, Rodriguez tells me. Then we learned they were taking him to the United States. That changed the situation completely. One of Rodriguez's first calls was to an unlikely figure, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, Emir of Qatar, with whom she cultivated a relationship. Now the responsibility rests on your shoulders, Rodriguez recalls him saying. You have a responsibility to preserve Venezuela. According to Rodriguez and U.S. officials, Qatari officials helped arrange a conference call between her and Rubio the afternoon of January 3. Is Maduro alive? She asked. Rubio assured her he was. To prove it, U.S. officials sent photographs of him in a jumpsuit aboard a helicopter en route to New York. The Secretary of State then delivered an ultimatum. Meet U.S. demands or face continued military pressure. Rodriguez agreed, and aide says she saw no viable alternative. If I'm completely honest, Rodriguez tells me, we never thought the capital of the country would be attacked, much less imagined what happened to the President and First Lady. She spoke to Trump for the first time the following morning. We discussed how diplomatic relations between Venezuela and the United States could be established, and what areas of common interest might be identified. Rodriguez says Trump wanted access to Venezuela's vast oil reserves, seeing them as a way to increase global supply, lower energy prices, strengthen the U.S. economy ahead of the midterm elections. But he delegated the logistics to Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, for whom uprooting leftist regimes in Latin America is a long-standing priority. As Secretary of State, he suddenly had an opportunity to pursue that ambition. Under the agreement, the U.S. would receive the proceeds from most Venezuelan oil exports, then disperse the money back through Venezuela's banking system. The structure, one senior U.S. official explains, would function like an escrow account. Washington would release funds only as Caracas met agreed upon conditions. By controlling the flow of revenue, the U.S. would gain leverage over how the money was spent, while limiting corruption and the influence of rival foreign powers. In return, Rodriguez would remain president, buoyed by an influx of American investment and the economic benefits of renewed integration. The Trump administration saw it as a straightforward trade-off: political stability in exchange for economic oversight, energy access, the strategic realignment of one of the world's most resource-rich countries. As our interview comes to an end, we wander through the sunlit gardens of the palace. I tell Rodriguez I'm flying home the next day, connecting through Miami on one of the newly restored commercial routes. She smiles. Pretty soon, she says, I can skip the layover. Maybe next time, she says, fly from Washington to Caracas. That article was abbreviated. Now to the View essay. Society is the heading. This Economy's Rules of Dating by Mahika Barua. Barua is a freelance journalist who is currently working on her memoir on friendships and love. I used to say that I would not want to date someone who lives with their parents or with roommates, but with the current cost of living crisis, who can blame them? The alternative is simply unaffordable. Actor Callum Turner echoed this sentiment when he was asked whether it's a red flag for someone with a full-time job to live with their parents. In this economy, that's fine. Monica Barbaro, his co-star in the film One Night Only, added, every millennial had to go back home after college to live with their parents. The only people I know who can afford to live by themselves are people who inherited money or property. I remember dating a guy in my early 20s who lived with his parents. We spent time at my flat or booked an Airbnb or a hotel, which was exhausting and annoying. When we broke up, I said, never again. The lack of stability was simply too frustrating to continue. But in the current economy, I'm changing my mind. I now hesitate to rule out a dating match just because he lives at home or with three flatmates. Many of us cannot afford anything different. In major cities like New York or London, the cost of living turns dating into a class issue. More than a quarter of Londoners live in poverty. Financial pressures are equally apparent across the Atlantic. Half of working-age New Yorkers are struggling to cover their basic needs. These challenges inevitably impact when, who, and how we date. This shift is part of a much broader redefinition of adulthood. For decades, dating advice assumed certain milestones: living independently, owning a car, buying a home, paying for dinner without thinking twice, signaled maturity and readiness for commitment. Those assumptions made sense when they were broadly attainable. Today, they often measure inherited wealth more than discipline or ambition. A generation facing soaring rents, stagnant wages, student debt, and an increasingly precarious labor market should not be judged by standards that were shaped in a very different economy. That creates a strange disconnect. We still talk about dating as though everyone is playing by the same rules, even as the financial starting line has become dramatically more unequal. Rejecting someone because they have roommates or live with family may once have seemed like a reasonable decision. Increasingly, it says more about housing markets than about someone's character. Adapting to this new moment can be easier said than done. For instance, on social media, women are being advised not to go on coffee dates because they're low effort. And while I understand the desire to feel like the person you're on a date with is invested in your connection, I fear the cost of living crisis can cause us to conflate cost with effort. On one hand, I agree, men who ask me out on a coffee date may be pursuing doing coffee dates with multiple women in the same week because it is affordable, which does not make me feel special. On the other hand, it's a quick way to gauge compatibility and invest accordingly, which is understandable. Dating itself can be very expensive. The average date costs Americans $189, according to the BMO Real Financial Progress Index for 2026. Nearly 3 in 4 men, 71%, said they expect to pay for everything on a date early on in a relationship. Among women, 52% said they expect to split the bill. Despite this majority, when actor Robert Pattinson recently said he agrees you should always split the check on a date, there was outrage in the comments section. People declared that it was a huge red flag, especially coming from a millionaire. But psychotherapist Lisa Chen, who specializes in relationships, believes the cost of living crisis has changed how people think about commitment. Especially with my Gen Z clients, I'm seeing how economic uncertainty contributes to a declining interest in seeking committed relationships, especially when traditional milestones like renting a place together or owning a home are not realistic, Chen says. The rules of dating are changing in response to economic realities. Many of Chen's clients have become interested in keeping relationships fluid, undefined, flexible, while they try to find jobs and build financial security. Rather than dating in a traditional sense, she said, her clients are often seeking companionship through situationships and friendships. It's not that they are not interested in pursuing conventional long-term relationships, they're just pushing it out. According to a survey by Intuit, 51% of Americans are going on fewer dates because of today's economy, and Gen Z is hit the hardest. Chen tells me traditional milestones like living independently, home ownership, or financial stability are not on the table. Most of my clients, especially recent graduates, are trying to find employment in a difficult market, she says, adding that the rise of AI has made it even harder for Gen Z, as their entry-level jobs have been disproportionately impacted by the technology. These shifting expectations came into sharper focus for me in an unexpected conversation with a stranger. A woman I met at the airport last week said she worries about her grown sons because a lot is expected out of men nowadays in terms of dating. I assured her I would not expect anything out of a man that I am not already doing for myself. I live with a flatmate, so I would never reject a man if he lived with a flatmate. But am I allowed to see it as a red flag if he's living at home with parents? Similarly, I would not be angry if someone asked me out for coffee. But am I allowed to feel unimpressed, especially when I take myself out on solo dinner dates regularly? In the modern dating landscape, the true differentiator is ambition, which is a reasonable thing to consider while determining whether this is a good match for you and remains a reliable marker of compatibility, says dating coach Myla Smith. Living with parents to save money for a deposit is one thing, she explains. Living with parents and spending all your money on hobbies, clothes, or gaming is a different story. Having a plan for one's financial future, in other words, is hot. Surprisingly, or perhaps not, credit scores are also now part of how people evaluate potential partners. According to a survey by the dating app Hily, or Hily, H-I-L-Y, 1 in 5 daters would not date someone with a score below 580, and 31% say an excellent credit score makes someone more attractive. Another Hily survey found 40, 34% of millennials and 37% of Gen Z believe being frugal is sexy. Perhaps that is the real shift that the cost of living crisis is demanding from us. Dating standards can exist, but they do need to be updated for an economy in which traditional markers of adulthood have become unattainable. Living alone or picking up every dinner bill are no longer reliable proxies for ambition. Instead, we are rewriting the rules of dating to adapt to the economic realities of this moment. I am not saying we should ignore financial responsibility. It is still reasonable to want a partner who's working toward a future. But there's a meaningful difference between someone who's making pragmatic decisions in an impossible economy and someone who lacks direction altogether. I, for one, would never date someone without that kind of focus and ambition for their future. Maybe it is time to question whether all those dating red flags were actually always about class. In a time when economic uncertainty defines nearly every aspect of adult life, the prize might be finding someone whose values and resilience can help you weather the economic winds together. Shared values, after all, can be the best sign that a life shared together will be worthwhile. There's a large photo spread here about the environment. I believe I have time to read one or two of the photographs. Let's see who gets credit for that. Photographs are by Matt Black and text by Justin Warland. Here's a couple. Becky and John Ball received a proposed South 3-2 agreement that would have required them to waive groundwater-related claims in exchange for well monitoring and mitigation. A man and a woman, both dressed in what I would consider work clothes, T-shirts, jeans, standing in front of what appears to be a Southwestern Native Peoples designed wall hanging. South 3-2 Hermosa, Patagonia Mountains, Arizona. South 3-2 Hermosa is emerging as the next big case study for the future of U.S. mining. The $2 billion zinc and manganese project was the first mining project to receive expedited federal permitting under a streamlined process earlier this year. Unlike most mining megaprojects, which require huge open pits, the Hermosa project is underground, minimizing visible footprint. We will mine for up to 70 years at this site and only disturb 750 acres in total, says Pat Rissner, the project's president. Still, many community tensions remain unresolved. The project sits in a biodiversity hotspot, home to jaguars and Mexican spotted owls. Locals are concerned mining operations may pollute the groundwater they rely on for household use. Negotiations over a community benefits agreement remain ongoing. And here is a black and white, these are all black and white photos, a black and white photo of a mine shaft. Inside the exploration decline, 600 feet below the surface, core samples are used to map and evaluate the underground mineral deposit. It is a shaft. It looks like a driveway through a cave. There are large tubes in the ceiling. Perhaps that's for air control, outside air getting inside. Smaller tubes are attached to the walls. I don't know, electricity or other utilities. And there's a small vehicle driving through this tunnel in this cave, which is a mine, 600 feet below ground. A couple of photos of miners also appear. Tyrell Todd worked in mining for 19 years and is currently a shaft sinking contractor at the Hermosa mine. It's a guy all decked out in mining paraphernalia, his work clothes. He's got the helmet with the light on it. He's wearing presumably safety goggles. They may be his own prescription eyewear as well. He has a beard, a mustache. He has something around his neck, a scarf or some kind of safety item, I suppose. Shadows of other miners on the walls in the Hermosa mine in the Patagonia Mountains of Arizona. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number where you can reach us here at the office and studios is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.